I'm off my game today.
No, you're not.
That's true.
People are going to have to start making better content.
I think we're going to be talking about this for a long time.
When you program for everyone, you program for no one.
I think it's that we're a purpose-driven platform. Like, we're trying to get to substance. How was that? Are you happy with that?
Yeah.
This is marketing therapy right now.
It really is.
What's up? I'm Laura Carenti.
And I'm Alexa Kristen. Welcome back to Adlandia, episode 23.
Happy holidays,
Adlandia. Happy holidays.
We're right in the thick of it.
When aren't we in the thick of it?
That's also true. It's been quite a year.
It's been an amazing year.
Amazing. So many fabulous conversations, insightful feedback.
Phenomenal audience.
Yeah, we are obsessed with our Adlandia community, which just continues to grow and inspire us. And all of the feedback and conversations that we're having on social has just been pure inspiration for a lot of the questions and guests that we have had. And so we can't thank all of you enough for sticking this out with us over the last 10 months, 11 months.
I think Adlandia is taking over.
That's right. 2018. But that said, we also know that the industry is super volatile right now. There's lots of change. There's lots of questions.
Everybody's talking about the media bubble.
Yeah. There's digital companies that aren't hitting their goals. There's consolidation. There's collaboration. There's a lot of people saying that the agency model's broken. The industry is falling apart. The sky is just crashing down around us.
What do we see?
Opportunity, baby.
A whole lot of opportunity.
When we sat down and we said, who do we need to bring on to close out
the year?
The year strong. Somebody that is going through change herself. Somebody that reflects, I think, everything that I and you
believe in.
That's Beth Comstock.
Yep.
So Beth, above and away of being obviously a change, and I think we've been on the front lines of actually seeing the way she operates.
And I think she's like the archetype in my mind for what leadership should be in the future.
What do you mean by that?
So magnanimous, giving people a voice and a platform, listening to maybe the people, the underdogs, or the quiet voices, and taking everyone with her.
Yeah.
That's something Beth has done, and I think that more leaders can learn from her and how to embrace change, but also create an environment where people feel safe to change themselves, to voice, you know, new ideas, and to challenge truly the status quo. And I don't know, my hope is that more people use Beth as a model for that.
I totally, right? I plus one that.
Yeah.
And I think as she is riding into the next chapter of her career, both literally and figuratively, she'll be putting out a book in 2018 about change. Imagine It Forward is the title. I think it's just interesting to kind of head into the interview and talk about what inspired her, what rattled her, what shaped her.
How she dealt with change and how she embraced it.
Right.
So with that, Beth Comstock.
We'll be right back. What's up, Adlandia? We're back in the studio with one of our favorites. Like favorite.
Yeah.
Girl boss, executive leaders.
Vice chairwoman of GE.
Beth Comstock. Welcome to the show, Beth.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Thanks for coming down and doing this with us.
Happy to. I'm a big fan of yours.
Oh, thank you.
You trekked all the way to Brooklyn.
I trekked to Brooklyn. I can do it.
It was funny.
I said, get my way here.
I asked her, I said, it's in Brooklyn. She's like, Alexa, I have no problem coming to Brooklyn.
Well, living in New Jersey, it's like going to Europe.
Yeah, that's a long trip for New Jersey.
Yeah, same thing. So, Beth, one of my questions that I've thought so much about when I think of you is you have this amazing career. And I've always wondered, was it more kind of premeditated, your moves, or was it more serendipitous?
It was definitely serendipitous. I would love to tell you I had a master plan and it all worked according to plan, but it didn't at all. I set out to have a career in media, and in many ways I did, but it wasn't the way I thought I would have it. So I started out thinking I was going to be a science reporter, and here I am, not at all doing that.
Never say never.
Never say never. But sure. I do think sometimes I should have been more deliberate in planning. You know, you tend to take, you get into the rhythm of your role, of your job, and you see the next thing ahead of you, and you think I have to have that as opposed to saying, do I need that? Is there something else? I didn't do as much of that.
Did you do a lot of like role creation in your career?
I did. I feel like job crafting is something that I really believe in, and it's something I really took to heart. And what do I mean by that? You take a job, usually a job that not everybody thinks is that great, and you make it really great because you see the potential in it that maybe others don't see.
Someone asked me recently actually about that. Like when you get into a job and you're not challenged, what do? And my response was, are you sure it's not challenging? And I feel like you actually taught me that, to look at things differently so that I found my own challenges. I found my own kind of road signs and road markers. I mean, was there ever a time where you kind of sat down and said, I'm not challenged, and then re-architected it so that you were, and that you created something new?
I feel like every job I've had has had some that point.
Yeah.
I think we all have those. We have jobs where you're like, oh, I've done everything, and then there's a new project that comes along, or you put your hand up and say, I'd love to get involved in that, and you do, but people don't think about it until you raise your hand to do it. I remember once there was a big job I wanted, and this was more about lack of confidence, but it was open for 6 months. I was working at NBC. It was open for 6 months, and they didn't fill it. So I marched up to the HR, the head of HR, and I was like, you know, I probably didn't march up. I tiptoed up and, you know, stood around his office and got my nerve up. And then I said, can I apply for that job? I was really indignant they hadn't asked me to apply for it. And he said, yeah, we thought about you, but you have daughters, and, you know, we didn't think you'd want to travel. And that was a big lesson. One, I wish he wouldn't have thought that. But two, I never put my hand up to say I wanted to do it, and I can decide if I'm going to travel or not.
Yeah.
So that was a good lesson to me, to just put yourself out there. And if you don't tell people what you want to do, they're never going to know it.
There's two valuable lessons in that.
Many.
One is the cultural context of what we're currently in is, you know, women, and we were tweeting about this the other day, like 2018 to us is like the year of women in media. Like it is full stop. Like
I think it's the year of women in business.
Yeah. And selfishly media. Yeah.
Media business.
Yeah. But, you know, it's interesting. But also, and I think we learned this really well from Mika Brzezinski, you know, it's like ask for what you want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so like never has the barrier been lower and the opportunity higher. So it's interesting to see where or how that's affected you as a woman in business over all these years.
Well, you said an important thing, ask for what you want. You have to know what you want, too.
Yeah.
I think a lot of us, certainly early in our careers, we don't always know what we want. I didn't always know what I wanted. So I think there's a lot of trying things out. The first job, there's some jobs you have to admit, hey, I got something out of this, but it's not going to get me where I want to go.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think you have to know what you want and not just take the thing that comes along either.
Super important.
The fear confidence thing you've talked a lot about in public, you know, talking about being an introvert. How have you kind of over time gotten over that? Or have you gotten over it? Is it more you've kind of quieted the voice of fear?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it, Lex. It's quieting that voice. And I think you realize that maybe everyone has those crazy voices
totally.
In their head, and at some point you're thinking you're the only one, and
you don't want to know what goes on in my head.
I would like to, actually. I think that'd be a fun place
a lot
to
of curse
tune
words.
Into.
A lot of curse words. Yeah.
But so, yeah, I think partly you have to get out of your own head. You just have to stop obsessing about it.
Yeah.
And I think just experience. You take one step and you go, maybe you're only proud to yourself. Sometimes it's the stupidest little thing. I ask a question in that meeting.
Yeah.
I ask one question. That's all it takes. It's just one question. And everybody else will be like, what? You know, and you just did it. So I think it's those kind of things for me that was just little series of challenges that I would push myself. And then I go, see, you can do it.
So you're unbelievably thoughtful in general. I think you're a thinker. Did you like think about, I'm going to reward myself? Like I have to tell myself that was good and then move on and then move on and then move on. I mean, was it self-reflection?
I think it's self-reflection. Yeah, I think it is, because it's also trying to get over that fear. You're just so fearful. It's that pit in your stomach. And and if you're not shy, or, you know, if you don't lack confidence, you don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But it is, and it's just getting over it. So you have to have that talk to yourself. The other thing that I do a lot is the second guessing and the after the fact, beat myself up. Oh, you should have asked that question. Oh, why'd you say that dumb thing? That's something that I've really had to work on, to just say it's over. It's done.
Yeah, you know, just move on. Laura says, Alexa, move on. She does all the time. She's like, move on.
But I'm guilty of that too. I'm guilty of that too. I mean, the amount of weight I've lost and then gained back in worrying about those things after the fact. And it's just like, it's what's done is done. And that's a difficult thing. You know, it's funny, you know, Alexa talks about you having, and you're very open about the introvert thing. So many talks we've seen you give, and you're very open about what that's been like as a leader. Yet we were just at a celebration in your honor where I think 10 of the 11 people who got up and spoke about you used the word, you're the spark. And I think there's some beautiful irony in having self-identified as an introvert, but all of the people you've worked with talk about you as the catalyst. How have you been able to shape that role over time and figuring out how to harness that ability and use it in a room where you've gone in and have met with everybody from, I'll give away a little bit about your book we'll talk about in a second, you know, the CIA to the team in Schenectady, you know?
Yeah, well, I think partly it's just experience and being older, right? You sort of work your way through that. But I had to get over that fear. And it's just lead with curiosity. Ask questions about people. For the people I work with, it's not about do what I say. It's about how do I help you do the best thing? How do I help you be the best person? And I think you have to get to that point where for a manager or somebody who leads a team, it's about the performance of the team. It's not about command and control, do what I say. Mm-hmm. So hearing that makes me feel really good because it's something I feel like I've really worked on.
Yeah.
And it's consider this. It's not do this. It's consider this. What do you think about this? So
sure.
I think you have to just work your way there. And there's a chemistry. It's working with people who you get each other, right? Mm-hmm. There's something really important when you work with people where you finish each other's sentences. You have a certain energy. It's not to say you're all alike. In fact, the teams we've worked with are all very different.
Right.
I think it's important to hire people with big differences. But you make it about the work, and you make it bigger than yourselves, and I think that's an important lesson.
Totally.
There are ideas all around you. I mean, there's no shortage of ideas. How have you created a little bit of a framework or a focus for yourself to say, this is the thing that I'm going to move forward with?
Well, as you know, Alexa, having worked together, I think I've been accused of chasing after too many ideas, and I will stand totally guilty of that. I haven't met an idea I don't love for maybe at least a minute. And so I think that's when I work with other people, it's like, I love this, you know, and if you're not careful, everybody's like, what do I do with this? I got to go investigate this, as opposed to saying, I love it. I don't know what to do with it. Let me figure it out and I'll come back to you. And if you don't come back, it's not that important. But to me, I like to wallow around in ideas. I like to see, is there a possibility here? I like to consider things. And I look a lot for patterns. You know, you see it once, you see it twice, you think it's a coincidence, you see it three times, and you go, wait, there's something there. And then I think it's a question of, can I bring that back to the company I work for? Can I bring it back to GE? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's interesting, but it doesn't make sense for us. So I think there's a lot of wallowing around in ideas, and I like doing that.
You and I were talking, I want to say 2 months ago, and we were talking about but there are a lot of ideas, and there are a lot of idea generators. But marrying a great idea with someone who can actually get it done and land the plane is so important. There's magic in that. How have you gone from, because you're not just an idea seeker. I mean, we've both worked with you. We know that you're an idea creator. And I think that's a huge differentiator, by the way, for people in business in general, because I think there are people who are really good at spotting great ideas that someone else has. And then there are also people who are really good at coming up with ideas. I think you are both. How do you, or is there kind of a Beth Comstock playbook, if you will, for getting a great idea into the right, you know, place that it's executable and impactful?
Yeah, I think it's a stick-to-itness. I think it's just not giving up on an idea that you feel passionately about. It doesn't mean it has to be executed exactly the way you see it in the beginning. It rarely is. But I think I've seen too many people who they lose interest after the first thing goes wrong. They lose patience because it's hard. And I don't know. I just think I've developed a fortitude to see an idea and really stick with it. And the teams we're in to keep going back in and find those moments when you just want to kill each other, that you sort of take a pause and you come back. So I think there's a bit of just recognizing the stages of ideas and the struggle, the messiness of it.
Yeah. You've talked a lot about not taking no for an answer. You've told some stories about working at NBC.
It's not the quote that I love, not to interject, but it's
It's like no, doesn't
no means not yet.
Yeah, no means
not
yet.
One of my favorite Beth Comstock isms.
It mine too.
I might tattoo it actually.
No,
we'll all go do it.
If you oh, yeah, let's in your, do can it. You write it and put it in your phone?
Yeah, I love it. So no means not yet. Has there ever been a moment where you're like, shit, I am pissing my boss off, or I'm pissing someone off by coming back with this idea?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
And how do you get over that and say, I don't give a shit, like, this is right?
Well, I think you have to be so passionate about that idea. You have to be like, I am going to die if this idea doesn't go forward. And I will do anything to make this idea happen.
Yeah.
And so you believe in the people who are behind the idea. You believe in the outcome of the idea. And so it's not about you.
Yeah.
So then you're just the vessel. You're just the one that gets in there. And I think there's an art to some of that they have to learn. There's a time. I've learned from various people I've worked with, you know, don't go and pitch them an idea on a Friday or whatever. So you have to pick your right moment when you, or, oh my gosh, this is they've just killed five ideas like this. I'm going to go back next week when I've done more homework.
Yeah.
So I think you have to be intuitive about how you do it, but you just let, you have to believe that idea so passionately that get out of my way, get out of my way, because if this has to happen.
You know, it's funny, having worked on the number of projects we have, and one of the things that I've always valued about our relationship as a marketer is that you bleed creativity in a world that is right now seemingly bogged down in data and, I'll use the word loosely, finance, and what we can afford. And I'm curious to know, as somebody who's been at the top of an organization like GE, how many years?
I've been at GE 27 years.
So a long time.
Half of it through NBC, but GE owned NBC.
And as somebody who...
Thomas Edison and I didn't start at the same time. I know you're thinking that. We really didn't.
I don't think that.
I don't have any good Edison gossip for you, sorry. I don't know what he was like to work with.
As somebody who's kind of seen, I'm sure, coming out of, you know, the financial crisis in the early 2000s and over the course of history, when marketing has always been the thing, or creativity has always been the thing that's easiest to wipe off the table because it doesn't match up to the bottom line. How have you faced that sort of adversity? I think there's a lot of marketers who listen to this show that go through ideas being sacrificed because they don't fit into a budget. What would you say to them?
Well, I think the first thing is don't always ask permission. I mean, obviously, everybody has a boss, and so you can't just do things without some sort of order in most companies. But what I mean by that is too often people go around trying to get everybody's okay and everybody's approval, as opposed to, I'm doing this, and I'd love your feedback to make sure you think it's great, but I'm doing this. I'm not asking you if I should do this. Mm-hmm. For example, legal often comes up a lot, or finance comes up. Yeah. And so if you go to finance and say, can I do this? They're probably going to say no, unless they understand the goals and objectives. If you say, here's what I'm doing, here's how I'm going to spend my money, you know, can you help me through this challenge? I think it's very different. So that I think is really it. And I think you need, if you can get customer data, feedback is always helpful. So if a customer loves a story you've done, you know, play that up inside your organization. Find a few examples. So-and-so liked it. I think it's a lot of selling your ideas inside before you ever sell the idea outside.
Sure. Yeah.
So you recently, I think it was a DigiDay article that I read, and said something about marketers. You said something about, and I'm paraphrasing you, please correct me, but marketers need to own their work. Do you think we've outsourced creativity at large to partners and people we perceive as having a creative solution rather than kind of having the will to do it ourselves?
Well, I don't think you can do everything yourself, so I think you do need great partners, but I think you just can't outsource everything. And I think you have to understand your strategy. You have to create your strategy. Everybody's in search of great strategy, but if it starts with you, I mean, what are you trying to accomplish? And so I worry a lot that people are trying to delegate that, and then they get frustrated. They're like, no one knows strategy, because you can't just make strategy out of nothing.
Right.
So that's something I worry about a lot. And I believe people need to own their story. You can't delegate your story to someone else. It has to be authentic. It has to be about you and the company you work for, in the case of marketers. And I worry too often everybody chases after trying to do, oh, that was a great idea, so let me copy that. Mm. As opposed to what's my interpretation of that. Mm. And they're very different, I think.
What are your so you have a ton of influences, and you've been really open about art, and you are a voracious reader. So when we were off mic, Beth said that she has a book fort that's basically built.
I'm
right
in the process
now
of building my book
fort, which I loved because I got a visual of you climbing into
you
your
have to
book
send us
fort.
A picture.
I will. I think that'd be fun. I'm going to do that.
I love it.
So I might have to shrink.
We'll put it on our we'll
tiny little super guy.
Exactly. Yeah. We'll post it on our Instagram.
I love it. And you have a lot, you've been really vocal about like pulling influences from different places, but what are some like maybe non-obvious influences that you've had in your life and in your career that people maybe don't know about?
Well, I grew up in a small town in the Shenandoah Valley, Winchester, Virginia. I think coming from a small town has had a huge influence on me. I mean, I've traveled the world, I've seen the world, I've worked for a very big company, I live in a very big city, New York City, but being from a small town has just given me a very different perspective. I mean, I grew up and everybody knows your name and it was all about your reputation. And, you know, my mother knew things before I ever did. My mother.
About you?
Oh my gosh. My mother had the best intelligence network. She was a school teacher and she would know things half the time before I even thought them. So I think there's something really just lovely about growing up in that respect. So you sort of appreciate community, you appreciate the value of a network and people who have your back. So perhaps you're more trusting in going out into the world because you know where people are from. So I think that's something important to know where you're from and not forget about that.
One thing that I always loved about you working with you was you rewarded people with your time. And I think that idea that you just described of community and of getting to know people really came through in your work. And for me, and I think Laura as well, when we would come in with an idea and we would see you like, you sparkle when you're excited about something. And it's exciting to see and it's exciting to be around. And what I thought was amazing was that you would reward us with some of your time.
But you say that like I was rewarded with the time too. I mean, that's what I love doing. It's just the energy, like you said, it's just it's the creativity, it's the teamwork, it's that riff in a team. And think of those sessions. I mean, it's to me, there's no place I'd rather be. It's just that energy and the give and take and the ideas. And it's not whose idea is great. It's just, let's get this out of the table. So I love that. I would, to tell you the truth, it wasn't giving my time. It was very selfish.
Well, it was amazing. And I think it is a kind of, in my mind, archetype, right, for leaders. I'm not sure that in general people feel like if they have an idea or they have or they're passionate about something that their leadership is going to understand it or even give enough time to it to sit down and work it through with them. And I think that that's really special. I mean, do you, you know, looking around at a lot of leaders you've met, do you think that there's more of that interpersonal side of business that needs to happen?
In a big way. I have this, I do this thing called Changemakers Book Club.
We love it.
Yeah.
I did one with Satya Nadella of Microsoft.
Great.
And I thought it was so unique, his perspective. Here he's leading with empathy and talking about it.
The
and
story putting, about his son was fascinating.
It's amazing. And putting it in a book. And at one point I said to him, but you have to understand, CEOs don't talk like you.
Yes.
How is that? And so I think hopefully you'll see more people. I mean, the company's doing well. He's hiring great people. So I think you when you see people like that, it's so unique. And I think the more they get celebrated, hopefully the more it will encourage other leaders to step forward and lead with empathy.
What are the lessons in leadership? I mean, obviously you've worked with leaders, governments, dignitaries all around the world. Is there a common denominator? You talked about looking for patterns that you found that really, especially in the world of brands and marketing and advertising, that you say, like, this is what I know a recipe for success is for a leader?
Well, I think a good leader who has a good brand and is known is they work really hard. And I think most people think they don't work, you know, maybe you think you don't work that hard, but they work really hard and they never take it for granted. I can think of leaders. I worked with Jack Welch earlier in my career. I remember to the day he retired, he was practicing Q&A to do interviews. He didn't have to do that at that. He was, you know, you see that with different leaders where they take nothing for granted. And so I think that's about a good brand. The other thing I think good leaders do is they stay relevant. It's you keep up with the times, you're open, you try to make sure you understand how things are changing. And so I think good leaders are open too.
What about change?
I think good leaders, hopefully they have diverse teams and they have people who bring them ideas and they listen to them. I think the worst thing leaders can do is that they just listen to people like them.
Yeah, it's so interesting. We're talking a lot on this show and have had executives in who represent what Alexa and I will politely call the old guard, people that have been in this industry for, you know, a number of years that are very esteemed jobs who are going through this. And then we also meet with a lot of what I'll call the new guard of executives, people that have developed startups and are entrepreneurial and challenging the way the industry works. And it's interesting to see how the ones who we seem to gravitate to, Alexa and I, are the ones that do what you just described. They stay relevant. They're willing and to listen and bring new people to the table, whereas the ones who we see struggling to maintain ad revenue or relevancy in the market are the ones who kind of subscribe to the, well, that's the way it's been done.
Yeah, it's frustrating. It's frustrating. I mean, I know, having worked with Jeff Immelt at GE, I mean, Alexa knows this. We would, Linda Boff and I would do a dinner at least once a year for him on media trends, long after GE got out of NBC. Just to keep contemporary, Jeff would want to know, he'd want to challenge people, he'd want to understand what is this new, you know, effort that, like, what's podcasting about? What is, whatever the newest technology in media was, he wanted to understand it. I always thought that was such a encouraging sign, and it sent a good sign to Linda and I. Hey, here's somebody who's interested in some of the work we're doing.
And you weren't, like, bringing in Jeff Zucker. I don't know why I picked his name. It has nothing to do with anything. You were bringing in people like Chris Poole.
Yeah.
Right? And created 4chan. Like,
we were bringing in a lot of different thinkers like that, and some of the new. I remember we brought in Anchor. You know, long before, I think they were just like out of the starting block. And he was very curious and very. And in fact, we did that on a lot of different subjects to Jeff and others. Just, I remember one really early on blockchain and Bitcoin.
Yeah,
you know, there's a part of the group that goes, oh, this is so irrelevant. This is never going to happen. This is a joke. And then there are the few people who are like, wow, what if? We were starting to say, what if, you know, as machines talk to machines, we may need that kind of currency for instantaneous transactions. So all you need is a couple of sparks, and then suddenly it's relevant and people get engaged.
How do you spot the what-ifers? It sounds like an obvious question, but it's really not.
It's not. I think you have to, honestly, I think you have to put them in those situations.
Yeah.
I think it's, I think all you can do is expose people to new ideas. One of the things we did at GE was we created this Global Insight Network, the GIN Network.
What and a good name.
Yeah, we should have drank
gin and
juice.
Gin and juice.
We totally failed on the experience because we didn't do anything with real gin. But but we got really great edge thinkers, like a great ones like Nina Tandon,
who
of EpiBone, who's 3D printing bones, and, you know, people like Nina.
Yeah.
And it was way out on the edge stuff, and we were just voyeurs. I mean, it was just a way to bring these people together and have them learn. There were like 20 of them, and they were talking with themselves, and it was just like brought to you by GE.
Well, I think we've gotten to this place. A lot of people in marketing talk about innovation and curiosity, and it's almost become like the word of the day.
Yeah.
You know, do we even know how to define innovation? Because everyone's defining it so many different ways.
Yeah, innovation, storytelling, another one, right?
But
the reason I think people are using them so much is because we still aren't good at it.
I totally agree.
Right, and so we're sort of like, here we go again. But if we were good at it, maybe we'd have different words for it.
You know, it's interesting having the unique opportunity to work for both of you as my clients. One of the things that I always appreciated was being able to come in and not be afraid to pitch or say anything, because there was such this ethos of freedom to fail and knowing that great ideas were going to come. Not every idea was going to hit the mark. I mean,
well, let's start with you had good ideas.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, Laura came in and she proved herself that this was not just, you know,
on record. We might have to rewind that later.
Yeah, exactly.
You had good ideas.
I never felt the intimidation factor I think a lot of people face, because there was this openness and willingness to say, it's okay if we fail, but if we don't try. So I've seen permission slips on your desk for your colleagues. I've seen you openly talk about failure as a plus. Can you talk about, in a world where we are anxiety ridden with this idea that if it's not perfect the first time, well, you know,
go
forget
home.
It. Yeah.
What you're talking to a recovering perfectionist. So I'm only somebody who's lived this my whole life. I don't like to fail. I'm not here to say I love to fail, and I haven't said, you know, Laura, fail because I love it.
Sure.
I just, let's do it. I feel like if you're into creativity, the first idea is never the best one, and you just have to keep working it and working it and working it. And At GE, we really sort of gravitated to tools, you know, things like Lean Startup, that this idea of a minimally viable product that give you a room to fail. But too often we put it on ourselves. We just beat ourselves up. So I think if you're going to be creative, you have to get over the perfectionist issue. The big thing for me was just asking for help. I remember early in my career, I was afraid to ask for help. It meant I have weak. I didn't ask my husband to help me with the groceries. I didn't ask, you know, my colleagues to help me at work. And I think I got feedback once saying, you just don't ask for help. You come in with your idea fully baked, and no one has any ability to put anything in here. And that was such important feedback. And I think if I hadn't stopped and done some work on that, I wouldn't be here, and I would be not very happy.
Is there one idea that, you know, are there any models that you're saying, that's really interesting, I would put my money down on this?
Well, I think there are these more targeted media companies you're seeing out there. I think, I mean, everybody's going gaga for podcasts. You guys are doing this because they love the sponsorship model. But it's just one model. I mean, I worry a little bit when things get put in a category of, now everybody has to follow this exact trend. It's media. It's the way I think it's just the pie is getting bigger. The slices get smaller. And so to your point, Laura, we all have to, if you like challenges, to be a marketer or in media right now is incredibly exciting. It just means you have to be doing more things and you have to have an experimental part of everything you do. And I think, again, back to where we said, I don't think people stick with it enough. Mm-hmm. So I think it's multimedia, and I'm not sure yet someone's come up with the perfect multimedia model. So if I were to say something that I'm curious about or that I'd love to be in search of, it's what's that right multimedia model where you can go from audio to video to something in text, and somehow it's integrated. And I think as people, we want more of that. I think also just the way we segment audiences and we think about it. I think it's really, I'd like to think we're going to much more of a state of mind segmentation.
Yes.
And people have that we're not just in a box. It's not just women of a certain age or, you know, we're not just business people. And I feel like we've been fighting that in marketing for a long time. And yet people are saying, I express myself differently in different ways. And we tend to look at it as the platform, not the expression.
Yeah. What are brands that you're looking at, Beth? I know obviously you've held a board seat at Nike, and we've talked at length over the brands over the years that served up as inspiration. As we turn the page into 2018, we've talked a lot on the show about, you know, certain direct-to-consumer brands that are just blowing our minds, like the Glossiers and the Caspers and all these guys who have figured out very specific models but have prioritized marketing as a way to kind of scale quickly. Are there, you know, a handful that you'd look to and say, hey, these are people I want to collaborate in the future with because they're doing it differently?
I've been intrigued by what WeWork has been doing this year. I mean, just when you think you know them, you think, oh, they're just this big, you know, they're just gobbling up office space everywhere. They take a twist and they look at something different. I thought, you know, them being an investor in The Wing was really smart. Yeah. I think what The Wing's been doing has been a really sort of moment, in a unique moment to express something that needed to be expressed in a pretty good way. I think it's those mashup things are really, really quite interesting.
Yeah. And I think it's new IP, which is something that we talk about a lot.
Like, IP that couldn't be created by being individualistic. Yeah. I think it's the collaborative nature that's appealing. So 27 years at GE, and you're moving on to your next chapter.
Literally.
Can you talk a bit about what comes next? And your book?
Well, two things. I have a book I'm coming out with in September that I'm finishing up right now. It's called Imagine It Forward. And it's very much just about change and sort of summoning courage at work to make change happen because you believe so passionately in an idea that you'll die if it doesn't happen. So I'm very much targeting it to people who are kind of just starting out or midway through their career. So I'm excited about that. But that's just, you know, will come out later in the year. And then I'm going to take some time and discover. I really want to just go off and sort of see what it's like to not have a set schedule and to not have a bunch of commitments and see what I am interested in. I've kind of forgotten some of those things about myself, or maybe I never knew them. So I'm very much just going to set off on a sort of discovery tour.
I love it.
Yeah, and I'd really like to go to some of these, I think in these smaller cities. I mean, you've seen Steve Case do that with his Rise of the Rest tour, where he's been looking at entrepreneurs. But I think there are some really interesting, there's really interesting creativity happening in a lot of cities, smaller cities around the country. And I this summer was in Portland, Maine. And, you know, you just find these. My husband and I went to this crazy marching band concert like in the middle of the night. And, you know, just these like, how did we get here? But this was a lot of fun. And so I think there's just a lot of creativity being expressed in different ways and people finding their way to be creative in places you wouldn't expect.
So you'll definitely learn new things about yourself, I'm sure, on these road trips.
Well, I learned I didn't like marching band music.
Really?
It was a fun experience, but I'm not going to go, like, follow this band.
Was there anything in writing your book that surprised yourself?
How hard it is. People say it's hard. I had a co-writer. I worked with a co-writer who's done a lot named Tal Raz. So that was hard because he's not in my head, and I had to, like, you know, interpret things. I had a job, so I spent all my weekends, so I haven't been exercising as much. I haven't read as many books as I'd like to. I don't know the latest cool music because I've been a hermit for the past 18 months.
You've been building your book for
it. So I think also just coming to terms with things that I didn't do right, you know, and just sort of in some ways I'm trying to be very personal and lessons learned, trying to be hopefully that lessons learned could be wisdom that someone else could take. So I think you have those moments where you have to go, you didn't do that well. And you have to own up to it.
Are there best values that you've never deviated from and that you would say, like, I'm proud that I kept true to those things?
It's a great question. I mean, I think believe in the team. You know, it's about the team. And if I've deviated from that, I always regret it, right? It's it catches up with you. I think just be truthful, right? Just, you know, I used to always fess up when something went wrong before I needed to. And I always felt that was just get ahead of it. Just say, this is a problem. We're going to deal with it as opposed to try to hide it. So that would be another thing. And I guess just stay hungry for good ideas. You're never done. It's just, you're never done. And then I guess my last thing is just, I work for better. I wake up every day. It's all about personal development, leadership development. I tend to like working with people like that. If we're all trying to get better together, it's a good place.
Yeah.
As somebody who is what we consider like the ultimate in girl boss, what was the most pivotal moment of your career?
Well, I think for me it was I was at CBS, top rated. I was doing CBS Entertainment Publicity, top rated network. And I went back to NBC and the news division, worst rated network. The news division was about to shut down. They had done real fake news. And it was one of the best jobs even today that I've ever had because it was rising up out of the ashes and we got to form a new team and anything was possible. And a lot of people told me not to take that job, that I'd ruin my career, I'd ruin my reputation, but I just knew I had to take it. So to me, that was pivotal just to be given that chance and frankly, just to take a chance on something that didn't seem clear. And it gave me confidence, hey, your gut's right, go with it.
Yeah.
What would be the one thing, because obviously people see you as one of the most powerful women in business in the world, what is something that people don't know about you that they would be absolutely shocked to learn?
Well, I'm a Howard Stern super fan, so I think people would be probably surprised to hear that.
So is Linda.
I don't think we've ever talked about that,
yeah,
actually.
She's like super Howard Stern fan.
Yeah, yeah. So
you should definitely stop there on your road trip.
I should. I don't think I have any juicy stories to share there, though. So I think that would probably be a shocker. I like really crazy. I like to laugh. I like really bawdy
jokes.
You're
actually really funny.
Well, I think people might be surprised to find I have a sense of humor.
You're very funny, and I actually
snarky
think you're a little
as hell too. I've seen you at a dinner
party.
Say,
you are like snarky. You're like
in the best way,
in the funniest little antagonistic, like cool, like hey, do you get it? Like smart, funny. And I remember walking in once and laughing at something you said, and no one else laughed, and I was like, guys. It's fucking funny.
So I think we've hit kill by DIY.
Do you know what this is?
You know our game?
We ask people at the end, what would you kill? Anything in the world, not humans. What would you buy if you could buy it? And what would you do yourself?
Well, right now I would like to do art myself.
Love.
I'd actually like to buy art if I had enough money. I'd love a Jean-Michel Basquiat. I love his artwork.
I love it.
And it's just, it's obscene, the money for that. So I, and then the other is...
What would you kill?
Kill. I just kill the hatred that's in the world right now. I just think, again, I worry that we're not thinking about the future. And yeah. I think we're just too sucked up in our trying to be right and our just hatred of people who we think aren't right, that we're not focusing on the future and making it happen.
Beth Comstock, it has been a super honor. And like, truly, Laura and I...
We're your super fans.
I love what you're doing with Atlantia. It's taking off.
You'll come back on your book tour, right?
I will if you'll have me back.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
But I think it's important to have fresh voices, and what you guys are doing to bring fresh voices. The media and marketing world isn't going to change unless we give people a chance to be heard. Yeah. And it's changing fast. And people, I think, don't believe how fast it's changing. It's changing faster than anyone can imagine.
Yeah, I agree. I think, Beth, I'm going to make a prediction for you for 2018 and beyond. You are going to be more badass, more powerful when the world gets to have you unleashed at large.
Wow, thank you. But I might not come out of my book for it, so I don't know.
Yeah, you will. We'll bring you out.
We'll drop the mic.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
So with that, thank you, Beth Comstock. We will be talking to you in 2018.
Come see us on your book tour.
Big thanks to Cameron Drews,
Matt Turk, Andy Bowers, and Jacob Weisberg, who stopped in the studio today. Good to see you, Jacob.
You've all been naughty. Maybe, Cam, you've been nice sometimes.
Sometimes.
And we hope, Atlantia, you have an amazing closeout of 2017.
We'll see you next year. Full disclosure, our opinions are our own.